Hello and welcome. You found the Social Work Podcast. My name is Jonathan Singer, and I'll be your host as we explore all things social work. Today's podcast is on race and social problems. I spoke with Dr. Larry Davis, Dean of the School of Social Work at the University of Pittsburgh, Donald M. Henderson Professor, and Director of the Center on Race and Social Problems. Prior to becoming the dean in 2001, Dr. Davis had been a faculty member at the George Warren Brown School of Social Work at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri since 1977, where he was a professor of social work and psychology and the holder of the E. Desmond Lee Chair in Ethnic and Racial Diversity. Dean Davis received his PhD from the University of Michigan's dual degree program in social work and psychology in 1977. His professional interests include interracial group dynamics, the impact of race, gender, and class on interpersonal interactions, African-American family formation, and youth. He's received research funding from sources such as the National Science Foundation and the National Institute of Health and National Institute of Mental Health. Dean Davis is the recipient of the University of Pittsburgh's Chancellor's 2007 Affirmative Action Award. In our conversation, Dean Davis defined racism, the role of race in understanding social problems, and how issues of race may or may not change as the percentage of whites in the United States continues to decrease. We talked about some of the racial and gender issues in the current election and talked about how race is different from gender as a point of diversity. We also talked about race and social work and what social workers can do to fight racism. We ended our conversation with a discussion of the Center on Race and Social Problems and what it's doing to fight racism. And now, on to the interview with Dean Larry Davis and Race and Social Problems. So, Dean Davis, I was wondering if you could define for us what you mean when you say race and what you mean by social problems. What is a social problem? What makes something a social problem?
Okay. The first one, what is race, is the more difficult of the two questions by a long shot. There are people who sort of talk about the myth of race, that there is no race, it's the human race. But for practical terms, it's a social construction that people do recognize that people are different colors and belong to what people consider the major racial groups, of course. For practical purposes, and I'll speak mainly thinking about here America, for America, the major definition has been color. Unlike some other countries which define people by other definitions. For example, I was in Singapore some many years ago, and I saw a person, and I asked a native there, what race was that person? And he said, oh, well, he's Malaysian or something. And I said, well, what about the next person? And he said, well, he was Chinese. And the person was Chinese, who was much darker than I am. I'm black. He said, this guy was much darker than I am. So I realized we had a problem. I said, this guy's not Chinese. He's, you know. He said, oh, no, he's Chinese. He talks Chinese. He walks Chinese. He was defining people culturally. America, that doesn't wash. America defines people racially. They don't care what language you speak or food you eat. It's sort of that if you look black, you are black. An example of this is Tiger Woods has tried desperately to be classified as something else. But America and the world continue to classify him as black. People sort of wonder why in New Orleans, why was New Orleans the sort of only place where we had terms like mulattoes? You figure you had slavery all over the country. Why New Orleans? Why just this little place where we sort of had mulattoes and octoroons? That's because the French basically had a sort of different notion of people and sort of identification and who was black and who was white. They sort of made these gradations. Fortunately, for African Americans, I think that the British really were really the ones, I guess, who took the lead and decided that everyone who had any black lineage was black. So that what it meant is that you have this huge group of black people who, despite their color gradations, are all black. I mean, Colin Powell's black, as is Lena Horne, as is Tiger Woods, as is Sidney Poitier. I mean, you have people of great gradation. So it didn't matter what color they were, as long as they were recognizably as having African ancestry. It may work different for some of the other groups that are coming along. You know, there may be a difference in Amerasian children, but in America, that this has been going on for 400 years. Basically, the union of African Americans with other populations. And if you have an African American and Asian, you don't have some sort of Asian person. You have some sort of black person.
It's the one drop rule.
It's the one drop rule. Exactly right. So that's sort of how it sort of worked. Now, whether people like that, you know, reality is another thing. But that's just sort of how it has worked. And I wrote an article once that showed up in the Chicago Tribune, maybe 1997, and I talked about that, the new ingredient in biracial identity. And the new ingredient really is is the identity of the white parent. That basically there's nothing new. You know, you have a white couple. We can talk about Obama even in this way. You have a white couple who have a black child, and they sort of say, aha, we have an interracial child. What you have is an African-American child. African-Americans are a multiracial people. 70% of African-Americans are thought to have white lineage. Some other higher percentage is thought, some other percentage lower is thought to have Indian percentage, and some even have Chinese heritage. So, I mean, that's who they are. It's like, it would be like going to Puerto Rico, sort of trying to pull out the Hispanics and the African out of that sort of group. But in some respects, that's true for black America, that we have these, for who is Lena Horne? Is she biracial? You know, I tell people that America may have biracial children, but it only has black adults. There are no biracial adults in America. These movie stars have kids, and they're beautiful biracial kids when they're kids, but when they show up on the cover of Ebony magazine 20 years later, she's the most beautiful black woman in America. They don't say she's the most beautiful biracial woman. It doesn't wash in America.
And why doesn't it wash? Why can't you have a biracial adult?
Because that's who we are. I mean, the term biracial fits the entire group. That's the problem. That people who sort of want to do this, well, I have a biracial child, really, is that all they're measuring when they do that, invariably they're measuring recency. Conceivably, you could have a white partner and an African partner, right, as we do in one of our presidential candidates.
That's right, Barack Obama.
Okay, you could have two, quote, black parents in America, both of whom have white lineage. In the past, somebody was white somewhere.
They could have been biracial as children.
They would have been classified as biracial as children.
Right.
So they have a child. So that child may, in fact, be whiter than is the child by the biracial couple, by the white and black and African couple. See, it doesn't make sense. See, people want to make this issue about sort of biracial children, but basically America doesn't respond to the notion. Policeman doesn't stop Obama and sort of say, hey, you know, what was your lineage? It's get out of the car, you so-and-so, let's get out. People don't do that to you. And the same thing with these children. When I advise couples to do this, they often don't like it, particularly the white partner, because the white partner is thinking that I want to change, give my kid, not to be identified with this group, and give my kid a sort of a leg up. But what you're doing is you really have only contributed in some biological and social sense to what's been going on in the country a long time. And the new ingredient is that as the white partner, the white parent, you're willing to stand up and say, yes, as this is my child. As in the past, many white women who had such children put them up for adoption. Many white guys who had these such children historically have basically just walked off from the situation, or in worst cases in slavery, sold them. Or in the best cases, began colleges for them. And that's, by and large, for many, the historically black colleges were begun for. That's why they started, because they were started for these children of slave masters. That's why there's this color and connection in America. People wonder, well, what's the deal with the color? Why is it fair-skinned blacks seem to be doing better than darker-skinned blacks? Because there's always this connection between color and privilege, because those were often, originally, many of the children of these unions. So this is nothing new. Frederick Douglass, who's actually very dark, had a white father. So is Frederick Douglass biracial? I guess he is. But when he walks down the street here, would anyone identify Frederick Douglass as being biracial? No. So it doesn't really make biological or social sense. And when people sort of try and do that, I think they're doing the child a disservice and the person a disservice. I think Obama has done the right thing with it. He identifies himself as a black American. He doesn't run around and I'm some biracial man, which people wouldn't respond to. So, for example, even if you considered Obama biracial, he married a quote black woman. Now they have a kid. Is the kid biracial now? Or is a kid African-American? You see what I mean? It's all these disputes, these little arguments that people have, that at best they're measuring recency and the identity of the parents. That basically the miscegenation took place more recently than someone else's took place. But conceivably the more recent combination of blacks and whites may not be as thorough as the past ones. So, you know, is his kids more interracial than Lena Horne? I doubt it.
So I can see why you said that the definition of race is a little bit more complicated than how you would define a social problem.
Oh, yeah. I didn't say much of a social problem at all.
That's right. So what is a social problem? What makes a problem social?
Well, it's a problem that we sort of all sort of recognize as being having. It's not unlike a medical problem, but it has some social basis in terms of we basically use them. I basically define them by sort of saying what they are, sort of educational issues, human relations issues. They have a, quote, social component to them. At the same time, even what we think of biological health problems have strong, you know, racial components to them because they influence where people live, what kind of jobs they have, what kind of schools they go to, what sort of hazards are parked next to their neighborhoods. So even what we might think of as sort of being biological issues often might result in having racial components, which result in, of course, other social problems for us. So the center, I guess that's why you sort of asked me about this a little bit, we do have a center called the Center on Race and Social Problems. We named it the Center on Race and Social Problems because often people don't want to talk about race. They'll talk about diversity. They'll talk about inner city. They'll talk about culture of the deprived. I mean, any term will do rather than talking about race. And we want to talk, even researchers. I've met researchers all my life who will do elaborate surveys and enter race into the equation last. And, you know, I mean, it's just not what they want to address. It's kind of the hot button. But race, in fairness to it, it's America's defining social problem. There's no topic in America which raises emotions more so than does the topic of race.
I'm really interested to hear what you have to think about this idea of how these issues of race and the questions of race and the way that race is constructed and viewed in terms of social problems and issues, and how that might change now that Hispanics are the majority minority group in the United States.
Well, I don't think it's going to work quite as people think it might. In 1980, 20% of the population was non-white. Now, some 20 years later, about 30% of the population is non-white. Frequently, you hear the discussion that by the year 2050, that 50% of the population will be non-white. The figures are about 12% African-American, 12-point-something for Hispanics. There's some point percentage difference between the two. The reason it won't be so simple in terms of just the numbers is because America, more so than anything else, follows the color line. And that even though that 13% or 12-some-point percent for Hispanics being the largest minority group, they will sort of respond like a minority group, but they won't in some respects. Some Hispanics are classified as being white and are considered as being white and responded to as being white and for all practical purposes are white people who speak Spanish. So you get, for example, Cubans. Cubans here are by and large a white population. Same is not true for Puerto Ricans, of whom many of whom are African Americans. In fact, the data on Puerto Ricans looks like black data with regards to social perils, unemployment, poverty rates, out of wedlock births, crime, those kinds of things. The data for Cubans looks like white data. So in that sense, you sort of have both of them are classified as Hispanic groups, which is why it's always difficult when we talk about Hispanics. We need to know who we're talking about because what we do is we put together a Puerto Rican group, a Cuban group, and the largest group, Mexican-Americans, which are 60%. So you put those together and you come out with a mean, but you don't know exactly who you're talking about. The groups such as Cubans, Argentinians, and Spaniards who are here lift up the mean for Hispanics on some given phenomena. But the larger group is probably truer measure of Hispanics is probably that of Mexican-Americans who sort of fall in the middle between. They also happen to fall in the middle in terms of some color. That if I, in the absence of anything else, I would tell someone to really look to tell me the color of the Hispanic group, and I would have a better chance of telling you how that color, how that Hispanic group is faring in America. So how they're faring will, at some point, have to do with how they're going to vote. So while they're going to be 12% of the population, they may not, or 13% of the population, they may not all vote like we think about Hispanics. That, say, some 5% may vote as whites, and the other 8% may vote as people of color. So it's not going to be as simple as people think. So that would be the main thing I would sort of say about how it's going to work. And it's also the difference, too. The Hispanic population is younger, and also we have to think about how well they're doing. The world isn't all about race and color. It's funny, there's a quote by Rolf Ellison that says that we should attempt to stare down the deadly and hypnotic temptation to see the world in all its vices in terms of race. Everything doesn't have to do with race. I mean, it's a powerful predictor, but it doesn't explain all the variance that goes on in our lives.
So clearly race is an important issue for you, as it is for the United States. But I'm wondering what you think is the importance of race for social workers. Why should social workers be concerned about race?
As we mentioned a little earlier, racism is America's defining social problem. I mean, it has a legacy in this country. It's been important to the making of the country. Virtually, I can't think of any problem that doesn't have some sort of racial component. When we look at the social ills of our society, whether it be crime, poor education, poor health care, poor quality of communities, we can look at them by race in some way, and that race often determines who is doing better than someone else. And by not acknowledging it, social workers really are not addressing the elephant in the room, that social workers in particular are committed more so than any other profession to work with low-income individuals and to fight for social justice. So for us not to acknowledge the importance of race is really not to address a major component of what's causing social injustice and societal inequities. So we have to sort of know something about this. I mean, even if the demographics weren't changing, but the fact that the demographics are changing, that you are having a higher percent of non-whites in the country, means that you will have a higher percent of cross-racial interactions, that whites who want to interact, to be relevant today, you might have been able to go in some backwoods place and hide from race in some another period of time. But I always tell people today that the character for crisis and opportunity are the same. And for those people who really want to be often at the heart of where things are going on in the country, the major crisis on the country, will really have to come in contact with these demographic changes that are occurring. So our students and social work students and our social professionals need to be aware of the issues. They need to be aware of their strengths and the liabilities in cross-racial interactions. They need to know the realities that their clients face. I mean, at one time, I think social work focused more on internal functioning, mainly because of its psychoanalytic bent, that basically the problems resided within the individual. But that very thing is what always has made social work different than psychology. The psychologists basically viewed the problem as residing within the individual's head. Somehow it was an intrapersonal problem. But social workers have always recognized the human behavior in the social environment, that the social environment was a major component, that where people lived, where they went to school, what was going on inside of their communities influenced greatly how they themselves become. And some people may say, oh, those things aren't important. If people want to do well, they can do well. And the same people are the ones who make sure that their kids are in some private school paying $18,000 a year. And I always want to say to them, you know, if the environment doesn't matter, if friends don't matter, if your context doesn't matter, then why are you willing to pay so much money to make sure that your kid is in this pristine environment? Because you do recognize that it matters on some level.
So one of the things that you mentioned earlier was that race is the defining issue. If I was talking to Gloria Steinem, she might say that gender is the defining issue. How could you say that they are different?
You know, this is interesting, because this Sunday's New York Times had an article on this very topic. I don't know if you saw it or not, but it I've forgotten what the woman's name was. It sounded like it's Harlan, but the black person's name was Frederick Douglass. Well, as it turns out, they had been sort of allies in both trying to get the right to vote. And it sort of came down as to who would get the right to vote first. Would it be men? In this case, would it be blacks get the right to vote as men? Or would it be women? And they argued about that. And one of the comments that was interesting that the women made, of course, the woman made, was, why should women be denied the vote and let someone from who is less lettered, unlettered, and a farmer and clearly not a socially sophisticated person vote when the women couldn't vote? And Frederick Douglass' response says, well, we'll support that when you're hunted down, when there's genocide being carried out against your group, when your brains are being smashed out in the and the sidewalks when you're being lynched by the thousands in the country, then we support such a view. And that's, but this is a fair debate. And it doesn't really go very, you know, very far, you know, in terms of that someone would say, of course, it is a gender issue and some would be the racial issue. But if you look at, you know, some demographics in terms of who is in prison, who has a longer or shorter life expectancy, who is better educated, who is hungry, whose kids do well. I mean, you know, you see this really major racial sort of thing coming up. Not that you don't want to say that gender. I mean, it's kind of, I don't really like getting into it because I don't find it that terribly productive. But you have to think that in terms of the people who are likely to be killed this evening, if you were to send a male and a black, either female or male, a black and a white out into society, that you would get that the white female would be less likely to be harmed, even by legitimate agents of our society, than would be the black person. What has happened with black women in terms of the movement? Is that largely what people argue is that the women's movement, that many black women aren't in it because race does trump gender for them, that even the white women don't treat them so well. So that this is, and they're double whammied, that they get, you know, their black women are perceived as even being less feminine than white women. So even within, even as women, they're discriminated against, even by the women who are their allies. So, and of course, occasionally you'll hear some black woman, some argument sort of saying something, well, your mother owned my mother, sort of. I mean, they really get really carried away and go back to the whole thing. But black women have real issues about the gender issue as well. So, you know, I don't think it's a particularly productive argument. But I do think that you're seeing some things take place with the present presidential election, where we do sort of see, hey, a black man running and a white female running. And we'll see how if people do vote with their identities or if they vote with what they think would be the best candidate.
So when you say if they vote with their identities, you're saying that women would vote for a woman, African-Americans would vote for an African-American.
Right, right. And what I thought was really what has made this race so noble up until this point is that black Americans did not immediately flock to Obama. That they sort of held their ground. His numbers were less than was Hillary's, and they were loyal to the Clintons. And I think that helped. I think it helped Obama sort of indirectly because it said to whites that these people are really trying to rise above this. They're trying to be noble in this struggle, that this is their candidate, and they're not just all just carte blanche running to the black candidate. And I think the introduction of, as it is now, I think the introduction of race and gender into the presidential debates really sort of hurts the whole discussion. I think the country was trying to sort of rise above it, but I don't think that it will.
And by the introduction of race, you're talking about the comment that Hillary Clinton made about Johnson and Martin Luther King and how King couldn't have done what he had done without Johnson, of course, white president, right. And that has brought race back into the issue, right. Into the race.
It was unfortunate because I agree with Obama said that. He didn't think that was her intent to do that either. I don't think it was – certainly I'm sure it wasn't her intent to do that, to sort of make that comment and to receive negatively by African Americans. But it did heighten the salience of race to the whole discussion. You know, but there is something to be said in terms of Hillary's point. It's sort of the discussion about do the times make the man or the man makes the times. I think if King had come along during Bush's time, I'm not so sure he would have been successful. He might have been. But it certainly didn't hurt to have Johnson in the White House, a Southerner who had some sense of legacy, some sense of wanting some change. But that's not what I don't think she meant that. I think, you know, she wanted to say the interplay between the two. But I think the whole introduction of race and gender in the discussion, again, is detrimental to the sort of the America's rising above it.
We have a woman candidate and an African-American candidate. Do you think that there's some way in which that is a setup for the Democrats in the sense that we have two groups that have traditionally been considered sort of oppressed running against each other?
No, I think it's a sign of the time. I think it's a great thing. I think that I think that Americans recognize that it spoke well for them. I think it's what's generated attention for the Democratic race. People are excited about the Democratic race, in part because you have these two historically unelectable people who are running. And it says that we've risen above some of the old racial or gender stereotypes, and we're trying to be bigger and better than we have been in the past. Now, I don't think it was a setup. I think Hillary generally wants to be president. I think it just worked out that way. Her husband president, and now she's got a chance to do it. She's smart. She's capable. And one thing I do feel good about the candidates is that I like all three Democratic candidates. Edwards, I could live with Edwards, no problem. Hillary, I think Hillary's smart enough, and she's done stuff. She knows things. She'd be a perfect president. And I think Obama would be fine as president. I think he does bring something that she doesn't. She does bring the experience. She does is Washington savvy, knows in that sense even world savvy. But he does bring hope that we'll do something different. We're tired of what we've done. So, both points are valid points. So either way, I think, it may boil down in a way that people didn't think it should happen, but I think ultimately we'll wind up with a good president.
So I want to ask you a question that takes us off of the issue of politics and back onto this issue of social workers. Do you think that there is let me back up. You came up with this idea of psychological majority, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what that means, and I was wondering if you thought that this issue of the percentage of whites in this country decreasing as compared to the percentage of non-whites in this country will have a positive effect on race relations or a detrimental effect on race relations.
Well, it's funny you should come back to that, huh? As I said to you doing a break, that I really have had but one original idea in my life, and it is something called a psychological majority. And essentially what it says is that because blacks are so often in the minority, that whites are accustomed to being overwhelmingly the majority, in that numbers of blacks which exceed the traditional numbers of African Americans in some setting can cause whites to feel, even though still in the numerical majority, to feel themselves outnumbered. And that's why I call it the psychological majority. That some ratio around 30%, we sort of know we pick up tipping points, but the argument that I make in one paper I wrote is that a group which has equal numbers of blacks and whites, say 50-50, that whites are psychologically outnumbered in that group because they're accustomed to being in a numerical majority. And now the numbers aren't to their favor, so they do feel themselves to be sort of some. So, for example, we see this happen a lot of things, bars, schools. But we do know from the literature and work in this area that the 50-50 ratio of black to whites in particular. Now, what's interesting about this discussion is what do the other groups contribute? Hispanics and Asians, as we sort of said, just figure it around the year 2050, what would that look like when we have 50-50 percent? So theoretically, you're right. As the numbers of non-whites increase relative to the numbers of whites, we might expect more friction, because this is where because what happens, at least in my own research, when there was a clear majority, when whites were either 25% or blacks were 25%, both groups seemed to understand whose group it was, whose school it is, whose bar it is, whose neighborhood it is. But when it got to 50-50, then there was this fight for dominance. Now, this really was true for men more so than for women. In fact, much of what we know about race relations or racial problems really have to do with male behavior. It's us, the guys who, because we strike these hierarchies. We want things hierarchical. Who's the boss? Who's the chief? It's an interesting comment that's sometimes made about women's groups. It sort of says that the problem with men's groups is that everyone wants to lead, and the problem with women's groups is that nobody wants to lead. So women are comfortable sort of without having sort of a strong hierarchical structure. But guys will establish one. So when you have this 50-50 ratio, it's the worst case scenario for sort of conflict between groups. Now, again, you introduce some of these other minority groups, and who knows exactly how it's going to work. But from what we know, we would expect that conflict in the country, as, for example, you have cities. I came here from St. Louis, which is 52% black, and Pittsburgh now, which is 27% black. I honestly think that there's more racial tension in St. Louis because there's really a competition for leadership. Whose city is it? Is St. Louis a black city? We have the numerical majority. But in Pittsburgh, it's like, well, it can't be a black city. Blacks get a fair share of it, but they're not going to run the town. But in St. Louis, they could conceivably, quote, run the town in the sense that they have the political numbers to sort of do that. And I think it causes once that number gets close like that, you also get a big white exodus, which has happened in St. Louis, and you have a lot of white flight from the city, which of course only makes the city blacker. So eventually blacks in fact finally do wind up inheriting the city. But it causes all sorts of problems with whites. It leaves the tax base and the educational level may drop because of the people in schools and whatever. It's similar to what happens with some of the African countries, that when whites left the country, then you're left with an uneducated group of people to sort of try and struggle to sort of run it. And in some respects, I think some of the cities, black cities now, well, because of the white exodus, of course, certainly they're short of tax base, but they're also struggling in other areas too.
So what can social workers do to fight racism?
Social work can sort of do, I think, a better job of addressing racism as a social problem, as a more of a macro problem. We sort of take it piecemeal. We sort of look at, race and mental health and race and criminal justice and race and child welfare, which is a good thing. Which is we do better than any other profession. All this diversity stuff, we were talking about this back in the 60s. In America, the business schools, the medical professions, they just started talking about it now. All the human behavior stuff and the environment stuff is important. Psychologists just now started talking about the environment. They just discovered the environment in the last, 10 years. And even now the stuff they're talking about doing. Public health, the same thing. They're talking about going to the community. We've always done that. It's been social work stuff. Service learning is what social workers, we've always done that stuff. And now other groups are sort of saying, yeah, we should have our students out there doing things. But it's what contributes to social work both ways. It's also what's given us a bad name in some respects because we engaged in what was correctly system blame, that we're sort of saying, yes, people do have problems, but not millions and millions of people who live in the same neighborhood. What happened? They all drank the same water. This whole block went paranoid. No, something must really be going on here. Of course. So now you're blaming the system. So you alienate people. Politicians don't like. I was a VISTA volunteer in New York City for 3 years, and they essentially got rid of VISTA. And the reason that they did is because we were like some 5% of the OEO budget. We were like 70% of the OEO problems, because there were naive students. Believing that, in fact, the populations we were going to work with were somehow deficient. We got there and found that, no, these people were actually pretty smart, but the school systems were lousy. The apartment buildings were uncared for. The food in the neighborhood was no good. The garbage wasn't picked up. There were crime. There were drug sellers that police allowed. There was a lot of corruption. There were a lot of things going on with the system. True enough, some of the people weren't so great. Some of them didn't have the best of behavior. But they were, in many respects, much of what was going on was caused by factors of system blame. System sort of things were going on. The system wasn't functioning well, which is why in social work we sort of have, we sort of divide up in these two camps. We sort of have macro, what we call micro and micro, that the macro people sort of look at more community, sort of larger sort of social systems, and the micro people look at sort of individual sort of behavior. We are still much more focused on individual behavior, like something like 87% of our students are micro people, and some only 13% really sort of look at larger community sort of systemic issues. If you go online and punch up race relations, you'll be lucky if you get any social worker. Kind of interesting, right? that at some one time I was doing that. I wanted to go online and pick up Race Relations in America. And you'll get up scholars, you'll see books, but not by social workers, which is really kind of interesting that somehow, I mean, when Clinton put together his committee on race in America, not a social worker was in. John Hope Franklin was there, a sociologist, some other people were there, but no social workers involved. And there's no group that's closer to the ground than us with regards to dealing with groups. I mean, with the interface of groups and communities. So we never looked at race as a phenomena, as a real entity that we sort of need to address on a more of a systemic level. We sort of addressed it on as it influenced particular social problems. But I was just struck by, and I challenge people to do that, go online, punch up race relations, and look to see how many social work scholars you get. That's not how our work is done. We've been attached to some particular problem. So I would like for social work to sort of, you know, recognize it is more systemic, is more of an issue than it is. We sort of address it. We do better than any other profession, I think, in doing it. Like, that's why I think it's important that we have the center on race and social problems. And to my knowledge, no other school of social work sort of has one, a center on race and social problems. They have problems that address race, or they do some diversity issues. But see, diversity issues can be anything, you know. But when you start talking about race, and which is why we named it that way. I wanted it to be race because ultimately at some point I'll cease to be. and someone will run the center. But they'll be faced with the decision. They'll either have to change the name or they'll have to continue to talk about race. So there are things that social workers can do. And I think just to mainly be willing to acknowledge race, get involved in racial sort of racial struggles, and not be afraid to sort of say, in fact, that what they're dealing with are racial problems.
And so the Center on Race and Social Problems, this is your center, not just your center, but the center that you started. And the purpose is to engage in scholarship around race and social problems. And you didn't say this, but I'm wondering, are you saying that it would be good for schools of social work to follow your lead and to actually establish centers on race and social problems?
Right, exactly right. I mean, that's exactly that. That's what was the purpose of this. And all my life, you know, sometimes I even think about when I see mental health. You know, we had to make the person mentally ill to address race. You couldn't sort of say, you know, this person basically is experiencing a racial problem. You had to connect it somehow to the mental health issue to address it if you were in mental health. True enough, some people do have mental difficulties. But many of them are very sane, and nothing's wrong with them except they're having racial problems. And we should be able to say that, yeah, the problem with this community is not that the whole block has a character disorder, but the whole block is not treated well by the police department, or the whole block is being discriminated by the city, that there are major racial issues of school boards. I mean, we look at school boards in the city. Major racial problems there. That's a racial problem. We have basically a majority black population of children being governed by a majority white population of administrators. And that's what the struggle often is about, that whites are sort of either don't want to pay taxes for schools in which their kids are no longer in, and whites want to retain control of the school system because their kids are in it, which I understand that. Blacks want more say about school system because it makes sense of them because the majority of their kids are in there, and they're the majority group in the public school system. So that's what we sort of are fighting about. But it's underneath this educational discussion is a discussion of race. And I'm just saying we need to be more upfront about what we're talking about.
One of the pieces of the Center on Race and Social Problems, one of the services that the center has provided that I have most enjoyed and most benefited from, as well have hundreds of others that I've seen, is this lecture series. And some of the issues that we've talked about today have been touched on by folks that you have brought in to speak. Having this entree to ideas and of course contacts for those of us who are interested in pursuing the research and the scholarship on this, it's just fabulous. But I would think that even if a school didn't have the resources or the support perhaps from the university or the community to have an entire center on race and social problems, that having speakers focus on these issues in a forum like the one that you provide brings these issues to the fore in a way that can only be beneficial for social work.
You know, for that, I want to, you know, I really want to really thank the provost at the University of Pittsburgh. I mean, I say that in private and public because it didn't have to go this way. I mean, the problems are real. They're there. The need for it is real. They're there. The center now is 5 years old, but I've had this idea for a center for many more years than that. But it was at Pittsburgh that people said, okay, we'll do it. You know, and I think it has worked. I think other places now recognize that, hey, maybe we should do it or we should have done it. And we're seeing a lot of people who are copying us, even within the university now, other departments or other schools around our university who are sort of having some series because they recognize how popular they've been. The speakers here have been tremendously successful. That it is, on any given lecture, a multiracial group of men and women who are multidisciplinary, town and gown, that is people from the university and people from the city, in a room talking about America's most affectively charged topic in a civil way. It is short of a miracle.
It's fabulous.
I mean, you know, that we met, we did exactly what we set out to do. In fact, we did more than we set out to do. We were surprised that the center has really done so well. I mean, we have 8 speakers a year, 4 each semester, and they've come from everywhere, Princeton, Harvard, Michigan, here. I mean, and we have a balance of sort of, we've done some things that are kind of unique with it. We've had a balance of sort of national and sort of local people. We sort of have the local people so it doesn't become too ethereal. So that, for example, we had the head of the Urban League to speak. We had a person who's been, in the case of Salahuddin, who's been the old guard here for black leadership in the city, who's struggled with the city for a long time and knows sort of what's been going on. We have people like Orlando Patterson, who's come in, or Elijah Anderson, who've come in, or Julian Bond, who've come in, or some other scholars and people who've come. So we have a mixture of people, and we have a mixture of also black and white speakers, which has really been helpful to us. And I was mentioning this to someone yesterday after the talk, is that the thing that I'm so very proud of that we managed to do is that we have, as I said earlier, it really is a multiracial group of people attending these things. I don't know if there's ever, you know, there's never a complete dominance by one group. I was going to say, I don't even know if blacks are ever the majority or if whites are always the majority. I don't know exactly how it goes. But because we've addressed it, it's not an African-American center. I tell people this in public. I tell people this in private, that it's not a black center. It's not a white center. Racism is America's problem. So let's not put it on any particular group to resolve it, to solve this problem. So, and I think that's reflected in the leadership of the center. There's Ralph Bangs, who's white. There's Hidi Amitani, who's Japanese. There are other people, you know, so it really has a multiracial balance and feel, and the speakers balanced by gender. So we go to great lengths, though, to sustain really racial and gender balance in the center. First and foremost, the center is a research outfit that our job is to produce high-quality research, race-related research. The second is to mentor scholars such as yourself, people who come through, who want to know things, who can be involved with us, work on projects, postdocs, those kinds of things. And the third area is what you're referring to already, and that is about the speaker series, the dissemination of information that people have. The center provides a forum. And to my knowledge, there was no place at the University of Pittsburgh where people could come together like we can and talk about it. I remember one lecture in particular, very early in the center's history, there's a woman here by the name of Kathy Blee. Kathy Blee's in sociology, and she studied some lynching. And here we were in this room talking about what is clearly a highly affective charged topic, lynching, in a context that we could never have done otherwise. Where would you find a group of people that could sit down, a multiracial group of people sit down and talk about this topic without either yelling at each other or feeling too guilty or feeling angry or something that would prohibit the conversation from being productive? Well, it happens in our school every month. Somebody comes in, and Jonathan, you're always there. Always look for you in the crowd because I know when you're there, then I can start. You typically ask questions or something, but they really have grown. And we did them thinking this little lecture series. We thought we'd have 30, 40 people. And now we have, virtually always we have 100, We may have 140 people who come in. It's really taken off, and it's really been one of the highlights of the center's development.
That's great. Well, Dean Davis, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to be here and talk with us today about issues of race and social problems.
Thanks, Jonathan. It's great to be with you.
I'm Jonathan Singer, and thanks for being with me today for another episode of the Social Work Podcast. If you missed an episode or have suggestions for future episodes, please visit socialworkpodcast.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit our online store at cafepress.com/SWpodcast. To all the social workers out there, keep up the good work. We'll see you next time at the Social Work Podcast.